the wireless telegraph.
Yeah, on top of the hill, they had several poles put up, antenna poles, and they had at that time the telegraph system was wooden poles with the antenna, a wire antenna stretched between them, and he had it in a configuration so that, as he explained it to us, no matter which way the weather was, the storms and the electric storms, whatnot, and the aurora, he was able to pick up wireless signals from San Francisco and Puget Sound at any time. But he said a single wire just wouldn't do it. And he was a good friend of mine after I got married. But he had the telegraph station, and he had the broadcast, and he also was the radio contact between the fish canneries and the fish boats at first. The fish plants didn't have their own radios. They weren't that common in those days. And many of the boats didn't even have radios. Most of the boats in those days had just a compass. And so Capps Hill was an area in the middle of town with, there was only one house up on top of the hill, and a fellow named Bob Tibbles built up there during the 40s. But on the back slope, there was a large tree with a hawser-type rope that all the kids and a lot of grown-ups even enjoyed as a merry-go-round. And they cut their limbs off the tree and so forth. And you could swing out way out over in the air. And it would be disaster if you ever fell, but we didn't. And it was just, a great place to play with all the kids. And people of all ages like to use the rope. And I haven't a clue who put the rope up, but somebody climbed that tree and did it. And the rope was probably, maybe 25 feet up in the tree, because it was a big, heavy rope, and it had a loop on the bottom for a long time, and then later just a knot when the loop broke. And it was just a lot of fun there. And then it sloped down along the boardwalk. Then we had a couple of homes, and of course shortly had the meat store, and he would get meat in on the ships, and anything that he didn't sell, he would bring in halves of beef and butcher them up, and people would buy meat from him, and then what wasn't going to keep, he would salt. So he always had salt meat, but he also had a lot of hams and bacons and chickens and stuff of that sort for people that wanted to buy meat. And if you wanted pork chops, he would cut them out of a side of a hog. And we always thought it was interesting to see everything he had, because, a meat store has that smell of fresh kill or whatever you want to call it. And whenever we could go in there, we'd buy something for our folks, and if we had to run to the store, and you'd have to go to his house, which was adjacent to the store, and get him, and he would have to go through this big rigmarole of what a hard time it was to get drone just to sell, 50 cents worth of meat and all this. We had to listen to all this, and as kids we thought it was funny, but you have to put up with it, because we couldn't sass anybody or we'd catch the devil when we got home. And there was no telephones in Soldovia in those days, but our mother seemed to know what was going on. If we got in trouble on the other end of town, my mother knew about it before I got home. And that happened more than once, quite a few times than once. Cause
what kinds of trouble did you get into?
Mostly fighting with other kids and stuff. Me and my brothers, we would wrestle and fight with each other, but if somebody else interfered, you know, we stuck together, and of course, people would complain about the Elsass boys ganging up on this kid or that kid, and so forth, and maybe we did. I don't remember. It seemed to me the odds were even. I don't remember, but it was just the way kids grow up, you know. And we played together and we fought together. And
what was the school like? What was your school experience?
Well, initially, the first school was, of course, the original school was at where the church is, the Russian church. The middle section of the church was built as a school to start with before it was a church. And that was, you know, back in the 1800s. And then the Bureau of Indian Affairs built a school right downtown, and they built a fairly large building. They were large classrooms with the high ceilings, you know, which in those days high ceilings were crazy because it was hard to heat, and they heated with coal.
Is that it?
No,
that's not it.
No. This is where the school was built later. It was two stories, but this is in the same spot, and it could be that they added the second floor, but it was bigger than this, and it was up off the ground. Mm-hmm. It was about. The steps in going into the BIA school was about 5-6 steps up. So that was probably built before I can remember.
This was there in. It shows up in a 1906 survey.
Yeah. See. Yeah, that's long before I could remember. And but it was a large. Two large rooms on the ground floor that had classes. There was a central storage area, and then there were stairs going upstairs, and there was rooms up there, but they were lower ceiling, and they were teacher quarters. So they had one end for the women teachers, one for the men. And I think they had like 3 or 4 teachers there. I don't remember exactly. And then the territory built the territorial school. And it was up near where that paint shop and the metal shop and stuff is for the school now, the big cement block building there. That was built after World War II as an armory. Gymnasium. They built several in Alaska at the time. I think Bob Bartlett managed to get the government to build these so-called armories so schools would have gyms because we didn't have a gym. And the territorial school was 4 rooms as classrooms with a recreation room, and that wound up being an additional school room. And so then they had the you know, K-12, and the high school had a lot of classes down in the basement, which was low ceiling and beams and stuff. And that's where the furnace was and the coal pile and so forth. But they made part of that as this school also. And if you go up and look now, down in front of where the territorial school, the cement steps are still there. A couple of years ago, I went up and checked, and they were still there. And of course, nobody needs cement steps, willing to pack them. They were quite wide, tapered, going on up to the school. And it was considered quite modern. You know, it had flush toilets. I imagine they piped it down to under the boardwalk now, because the first flush toilets in Soldovia all drained right into the slough. Everybody along the slough, their toilets drained into the slough.
When were the first flush toilets?
Well, about 1940, 41, somewhere right in there, the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, under President Roosevelt, they put the first water system in. And I think Mr. Malcolm was the foreman on the project, and my dad worked on it. And they hand dug all the ditches, because that's the only way to dig. There was no mechanical diggers. And they built a log dam, not quite as far up as the present dam. And from there, they had a trestle that they built the box around and insulated the pipe. And then from there, it went into the ground and down the hill and across the airport, just similar to what the pipeline is now. And it was the reducing station was on this side of the slough. And as they built the line, people would plug into the line. So they would build a section of line to a valve station and then turn the water on there and go from there. So people, as the line was built, people were getting water. Now, when the ditch went by our house, it was about 10 feet from our basement wall, and my dad measured the depth to the pipe, and then he went in our basement and measured the same depth, and he took a piece of galvanized pipe with a cap on the end of it, and he hammered it through the dirt. So we didn't have to dig a ditch. It was already like about 4 feet under the ground. And so he had the thing all ready. So when they put the valves in the pipe, they just hooked in, and he had a valve on the inside in our basement. And we had running water. And from there, he piped it up into the kitchen and made a... with the can, he made a drain that drained out into the slough. So we could turn the water on and run all day and just run into the slough, see, if we wanted to. But, of course, our mother wouldn't let us. And so we had cold water running. I mean, it was a miracle. We didn't have to pack water no more. And it was a great day for us. And other homes, when the pipe went by them, they put in a fitting for them in a valve, but they didn't get around to, they either didn't have the pipe or they weren't ready and so forth. Now our neighbor John Olson, he was ready, and our neighbor across the street, the Olsons, they put their water in all at the same time we did. We all got water the same day, and then the pipeline went on down through town. And went clear to the end of town. And there was two places where they had blowout valves for high pressure. And if the pressure built up for whatever reason, those blowouts would open. And one was under the boardwalk, so you could tell if there was a problem. And they'd call the water people, and they'd take care of it. When Soldovia got running water, that was a real big day for everybody. But it didn't all happen in one day. It took a long time. And at the same time, they had the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, working building a road, supposedly to go to Port Graham, but it got up to the head of Soldovia. And at that time, the pipeline ran right down the trail. Our trail along here was only 4 feet wide enough to put a wheelbarrow or a sled, and it wasn't like today. And So we had everybody shoveled snow. Everybody that lived along, you know, we had to go out and shovel the snow. And we also put ashes when it was icy. Everybody had coal ashes, and you didn't just throw them away in the wintertime. You saved them for the street. And so when you got home, your feet were full of muddy ashes material, and my folks had these mats, and you had to take your shoes off, and we wore slippers in the house, and we used these lace-up boots was common in those days, and shoe packs, shoe packs were something we all liked because you could slip into them so easy, and you could wade with them, where if you wore the leather boots, you had to keep them greased for waterproofing. But, you know, for a kid in those days, those were important things, taking care of your shoes and taking care of your boots. It was really a big deal. And today, kids don't think of that. You know, they just cry to their mama to get a new pair of shoes. And everything we got had to come from Sears Roebuck or Montgomery Ward. There was stores here, but my folks ordered from the catalog a lot. Then as the road went on down to where the boardwalk started, see, it got wider and wider, so the road kind of just naturally widened. Then the bridge that we had at the time was a cantilever bridge because boats had to come up to the sawmill to pick up lumber and so forth. There was a bridge tender, lived right where that bridge tender's house is, Mr. Garner. And he had a system to... The far side of the bridge worked on a cantilever, so if you let the first part go, it would lift automatically, and it had a rope hanging down. And we always watched when a boat went through its rigging, because the rope would glide along their rigging, and, you know, it never got snagged, never did that I know of, but we always watched to see if it would. And then this side of the bridge, you had to crank it up and crank it down. So when you cranked the bridge down, Mr. Garner was an elderly humpback man, and he would let us crank the bridge, you know, and we liked it, you know, and it was not that easy to do. But when you got so far, there was a mark where you had to stop on the rail of the bridge. It marked, then you could reach out and get the line from the other side and pull that bridge down, pull that part of the cantilever down with the rope, and then you laid the one bridge down on top of the other. Then it was open again for traffic. And, of course, it was only a walking bridge. It wasn't wide enough for a vehicle. Then later they built what was called the Yellow Bridge. The initial bridge wasn't painted. Before that, they had anchored boards down in the slough where people could cross at low tide, but that was before I could remember. My first memories was the cantilever bridge. Then Mr. Garner, when everything was secure and there was pins he had to put in the bridge to make sure it was secure, he would take the crank home. He never let us have the crank unless he was standing there. But whoever designed and built the bridge, you know, really engineered it right. It was wide enough that large boats could come up in the slough at high tide, and they had barges where they loaded the lumber on at low tide, and they would tow them on out and up to the fish canneries and so forth around Cook Inlet. But it was a very busy sawmill. There was about 8 or 9 men working there all the time.
Was it noisy?
Huh?
Was it noisy?
It had a one-cylinder Fairbanks Morse engine with a, it had a 14-inch piston with a 16-inch stroke on it. In later years, I worked it, so I got to know the engine very well. And to start it, you had...
Fairbanks Morse...
The engine.
Engine.
Yeah, that old engine. It run the sawmill for years, and when it would start running, it would go boom, 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 as it would fire. And every time it fired, it would make these smoke rings through the stack. So you could see on a calm day, you could see the smoke rings going up in the sky. And being right over there, it was fairly close to the house, and we always heard it, you know, real loud. And whenever they were sawing in a hard log or pulling logs up out of the mill pond, you could hear the engines slow down. But it would stand there, and it was on a cement block, and it would jump. And after about 40 years, when they took all this up down...
That sawmill was running for 40 years, you think?
Oh, yes, yes. Let's see, it ran through the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and into the 60s. And then it collapsed from snow. And that was the end of the sawmill. But the engine bolts that held it in the cement block, there was about a half inch of space around the things. Just from the vibrations, it wore the concrete out. And it actually wasn't bolted down. It was just sitting. The weight of the engine kept it from falling off the concrete. And there was a small hand crank motor that pumped air to start them. The engine started with air. And it was a great thing to be in the engine room when the engine started, you know, because it was belt-driven shafts to the sawmill, and you would see the main flywheel, which was about 6 foot high and probably weighed in a neighborhood of 3 or 4 tons, heavy, heavy flywheel. And it would turn the belts, and as the belts would go, we used to put things on the belt and to see how far they'd go, because we knew when they got to the big flywheel, they'd get smashed, pieces of wood and so forth. And they'd come out the other side just all pulverized. And, of course, the mill owner at that time was Mr. Murphy, and he would chase us out, you know. But the sawmill, at that time, the sawdust from the mill was by a chain drive taken up into a large hopper car, and they had railroad tracks going out into the swamp by Lake Susan, where my brother's warehouses are now. And this track was up on a trestle about 6 feet above the ground. And so then they would go out with a cart full of sawdust. They pushed it by hand. And that was one thing they let us kids do. You know, we did a lot of things that people let us do that actually was work for them. But then they'd pull the pin and let all the sawdust out. And then we had fresh sawdust to play in and so forth. And it was a great sawdust pile there for years and years. And people would come and get sawdust for insulation in the homes. And, matter of fact, the insulation in our house was sawdust. My dad poured it in and as he built the house. But the sawmill, you know, cranked out a lot of local domestic lumber. But the big thing was the boardwalk contracts and the timber for the fish traps and things like that. The bigger the timbers they could cut, the better money they made. In later years, the track was taken down, and they just dumped the sawdust and went into the slough. And which really wasn't good for the fish, and there was a lot of herring in the slough at the time, and some salmon, and then of course all the humpies that went up Fish Creek. But there would be times when the tides would take sawdust up into the lagoon to where the lagoon was covered with sawdust, and then it would all absorb the water and either drift out or wash up on the shores. But, you know, within a few days it was gone. But I recall a lot of people talking about that, how terrible it was. And I couldn't understand why it was terrible, but that was the thing. But the sawmill did a lot of good in that it produced the material, and they brought logs in from Dogfish Bay, down south of Port Graham, and up Seldovia Bay, and even up Fish Creek they drug logs out from there with a small cat, and also up in Tutka Bay area, and anyway, up in that area. But so they brought logs in large rafts, and they would bring it. Some of the rafts were too large to get through the bridge. They were too wide, so they'd have to break them up down in the bay and tow up smaller rafts. And they had a couple of boats, fishing boats, that would work for them and do that. And the mill was originally built by a fellow named Martin Peterson and Zenas Beach Sr., who was called Shorty Beach. I doubt that many people knew his real name. They built the mill together, and they built a couple of boats out of the lumber they cut in the mill, and then they sold it to Mr. Murphy. And Murphy sold the mill to Casey Patton, who ran it for several years. And then he sold to Mr. Swedlin, and Mr. Swedlin owned it at the time that the snow collapsed it. And that was the end of the mill at that point. Also, right across the slough was a steam-driven mill owned by Mr. Swedlin's father. And
what was this mill driven? This was a oil?
This was driven diesel? By diesel, uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. The Fairbanks Morse engine was a diesel-driven, which was in those days much more modern than the steam-driven. In the steam-driven mill, they burned slab wood and also the narrow tops of logs. And any log that wouldn't make lumber, and if it had too much knots for lumber, because it, you know, with the amount of wood available, there was no need to get a lot of knots in your lumber, because spruce tends to shrink, and the knots drop out, and you got holes in the boards. So Mr. Swedlin, he had the steam-driven mill, and he had an overhead system built over the mill, but it was never enclosed. I think they covered the mill with tarps during the snowstorms and so forth, as I recall. Mr. Swedlin, who bought the diesel mill, was telling us about when his dad, he cut lumber, but he could never cut enough to keep for himself because there was such a demand for lumber for domestic use. Then we had a mill before that even up at Powder Island, which was Keller's mill. And Keller also, his was steam-driven. He had two large boilers. But he also used coal to burn in his mill. He got coal from Bluff Point on the Homer side, just like everybody else did here. And he hired quite a few guys, and he had much better production than Swedlin did. But one day the mill burned, and that was the end of that mill. And so timbering in Seldovia, the sawmill in through the years was pretty active. The big thing was getting guys to go out and cut logs, and bring them in. That was the other thing. I know at one time, when I was a kid, there was all this talk about a large raft of logs down in Dogfish Bay that the workers had cut, and then they caught a boat and came to town and left the raft. They never brought it. And then later, a boat went down and brought the raft up, and I don't remember how they ever settled on ownership or whatever, but I didn't know any of that. But I know the, when I was probably around 8 or 9, or hearing all this talk about this tremendous raft of logs that was abandoned, and because the guys wanted to go to town and celebrate. And so, you know, cutting trees with crosscut saws wasn't that easy, and we cut all our firewood with crosscut saws. But my dad had a furnace that burned coal, and he would get coal from Bluff Point, like everybody in the fall time went over. September was time for bringing coal in. And our basement was such that he could open the doors right to the slough, and the boats could drop the coal right inside the, so we didn't have to pack it up off the beach like most people did. The boats would bring the coal in, dump it on the beach, and then people would pack it up from the beach. And ours was, my dad was pretty ingenious in the things that he did. He built a mast and boom on our boardwalk over the water so that he could swing the boom out and lift logs up and put them right in the sawhorses for sawing. And of course, in doing that, it was all with rope and by hand. And we would get a whole bunch of kids to help pull the rope to lift the logs. And it was a, you know, it was a great operation for us. And to my dad, it was just work, you know, but we enjoyed it. So growing up in Soldovia was interesting that I don't know of any kid that didn't have to do chores. Everybody had a lot to do, you know, but yet we had time to play too. That was pretty important.
I've got a question about fish traps. Can you describe where the fish traps were located in the area here?
Locally in Kachemak, there was a fish trap down at Flat Island, on the inside of Flat Island, just outside of Nunwalik. Then there was a fish trap here at Soldovia, just in the cove right outside the bay, just below Hone Spit. There was a fish trap. These were all pile-driven traps. They weren't floating traps. And there was one at McDonald Spit, just outside of Kasitna Bay. There was one over at Diamond Creek and Bluff Point side. That was the longest trap in Alaska. It reached way out. And when the season was over, the fish plants would pull the traps up for the winter, pull the piling and stack them up. And the Bluff Point trap, every other year they pulled it. They most of the times they'd leave it there. And apparently it was pretty hard driving it in the coal seams over there and so forth. But it was a long, long trap, longest one in Alaska. Then there was traps on up Cook Inlet as you get past Anchor Point. But these traps here were all operated by Fidelgo Island Packing Company out of Port Graham. But they were all local people working on them.
And so they all went to the fish all went to the cannery in Port Graham?
Right, yeah. Yep. Fidelgo Island Packing was a large cannery down there. And back about in the 60s or somewhere, right in that time, it burned. But
did you ever work on the fish traps?
No, my dad had a fish trap for 30-some years, but I never did. I was on them, you know, with him, but I never worked one. One time when I was gill netting with a friend. We went to his trap. They were brailing 20 to 25,000 fish every day. And the trap was just full. And we asked him if we couldn't take a few, you know. The trap belonged to Libby McNeil and Libby. And he would not allow that. He was a true company man. And, you know, those guys, like my father and all his friends, they were convinced that if you didn't skimp and save, Libby's would go broke. You know, they're a nationwide, worldwide company, you know. So when my dad came home from the fish trap, he would buy the winter supply of groceries from the cannery up there they had in the store. So we ate a lot of Libby's products. Other people that worked for Alaska Packers, that was Del Monte products. And their Calpak second brand, so there's a lot of Calpak foods here. And I can't remember the others, but people bought from the traps at the end of the year, or from the canneries that owned the fish traps. It was just, they would sell to their people, like my dad, you know, who was a good friend of the superintendents and so forth, at a cut rate price. And, of course, they didn't want to be stuck with the food all winter, you know, to freeze and whatnot. So it worked out well for us. And in our basement, the shelves were all Libby's products. It we didn't see Del Monte products. But, you know, it was good, wholesome food. And then, of course, we bought in the stores. We had several stores at the time. There was Mr. Young had a store, H.S. Young Mercantile, and Charlie Sharp had a Solovia Cash store. Baldazar's had a clothing store. Solovia Pay Packing Company, which is Squeaky Anderson's, had a commissary, and Morris & Morris store was on this end of the boardwalk. So we had a lot of stores, and then we had the meat store, Shortley's Meat Store, and we had the movie theater down, initially down on the end of the boardwalk at Joe Hill's bar and dance hall.
Do you remember any of the movies you saw there?
No, we went to the movies, but I don't remember the names. I remember one thing was that if you missed a movie, you missed a cereal. There used to be cereals. And, they had the news, and they had the comedy, and they had the cereal, and the previews. And the previews were movies we never ever saw. They wouldn't buy them or whatever. You know, so they didn't mean much, but we watched. and the movie was two and three reels. And so when you went to the theater, initially at Joe Hill's, it cost 12 cents. And it was hard to raise 12 cents. But you had to set up the chairs and the benches. All those kids had to sit on benches, and the grown-ups sat in folding wood chairs. And then people visited, and then the movie would start. And, you had to be quiet, you know, no talking during the movie and so forth. And, the movie was on the screen, and the sound was back here. But, you know, to us, that was wonderful. Then when the reel was over, instead of just putting another reel on, they would rewind that reel. They turned the lights on, and everybody got this visit for a while. Then they blink the lights, so you all run for your seat and sit down and watch the next reel. And then if the movie stopped, but it wasn't the end, we knew there was a third reel. Because we never, I don't remember ever asking, you know, I'm sure people did, but I never did. It wasn't until they showed the third reel that we felt like we really got a long movie. And we got our money's worth if we got a third reel. But the serials were always cowboy things. And, of course, you know, every kid wants to be a cowboy. And so we had to see the serial. And, boy, if we missed, that was disaster. And it was once a week, you know. And then later, after Joe Hill's place burned, Carl Lindstedt had, and Joe Wood, they had built the Linwood Bar. It was named after Lindstedt and Mr. Wood. And they had built out behind the bar on Piley a dance hall, and then they started showing movies too. And Carl had high school kids run the projectors and stuff. Being from Sweden, he didn't really savvy that much in modern technology. And it was the same thing. We had, but they had a side door through an alley, covered alley, that went into the theater, so the kids didn't have to go through the bar, and people that objected to the bars too. You know, even in those days, we had do-gooders telling people how they should live or what they shouldn't do in life. But the movies were great, and they were great time to visit and so forth. Then Junior Anderson, Jack Anderson Jr., he built the theater along the boardwalk, and it was the first slope theater that we had. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it had real theater seats. You know, it was first class. And but they had in the projection on the screen, it would be a little orange dot would come when it's time to switch reels, but they had two projectors. But Junior and whoever he hired to run the projectors would always miss the dot, you know, and then there'd be a blank spot till they got the thing going again. And it was hilarious because we all laughed, you know, he would get mad and you know, telling us to shut up and so forth. And they sold popcorn. They're out of a popcorn making machine like you see in the theaters. It was the first one we ever saw. And you could get hot buttered popcorn, and boy, that was a treat. And right across from the theater was a soda shop, and they had a soda fountain. And I'm trying to think of the girl that ran it. She would make ham and cheese sandwiches and so forth. You know, a pretty good soda fountain, a nice place to go after the movie, and being right over the water, it was a terrific view with the windows. She sold candies and gum and so forth. But she would watch the movie, but she'd never get to see the end of the movie because she'd have to dash over and open the soda shop and warm up the grill and stuff like that. And she always wanted somebody to do that for her, but I don't recall anybody offering to do it. I know I didn't. But the theater was there right up until the earthquake. After Junior had it, a fellow named Pete Polson had it, and then he built the theater after the earthquake with Urban Renewal and so forth. But Urban Renewal changed Saldovia drastically. It was,
well, seems like a good place to ask what your experience was when the earthquake happened.
I lived on the east end of the bridge. I don't know if you noticed the red warehouse there. I built that, and there was a two-story house I had behind it. And it was my daughter's fourth birthday, and we were having a birthday party. And so there was all these 4 and 5 year old kids at the birthday party. And we were taking pictures and having a good time. And they, fortunately, they already had eaten the cake and ice cream, and they were playing games. And I was trying to reload my camera when the earthquake, and I couldn't get my hands together. Something wasn't gelling. And then I noticed everything was shaking. And so I put the camera down, and the girls didn't seem to mind. I remember real clear that even though we were shaking, they were having fun. But my wife, she realized when she screamed earthquake, and oh boy, that set them kids off. And so I got them outside on our walkway outside the house, and they're all hanging on to me, screaming and crying.